You're listening to radio news about radio waves. Headlines from the ether. You're tuned to This Week in Radio News. I'm Tom Rowe in the Wave Farm Study Center in upstate New York. After talking about saving AM radio for the past 2 years, Federal Communications Commission released its AM Radio Revitalization Report and Order October 23rd. Plan to save AM radio is finally here, and the answer is largely to move AM stations onto the FM band. Chairman Tom Wheeler, a Democrat, said the order will, quote, ease regulatory burdens on AM broadcasters and address practical problems and interference-related issues that have long plagued AM stations, unquote. Commissioner Ajit Pai, the Republican leading the charge to bring back old-time AM radio, released a statement with Commissioner Mignon Clyburn that said the order, quote, acknowledges the realities of the upcoming incentive auction and the need for immediate relief for AM stations, unquote. That means he's happy commercial AM broadcasters are going to have their way on the FM frequencies through translator auctions. Now, the commission will next year allow AM licensees to acquire an FM translator, even relocating one from up to 250 miles away if necessary. The next year, the FCC will hold more translator auctions windows for AM broadcasters. Many other minor actions were taken to save AM radio, but the biggest is this translator giveaway, which may preclude or preempt low-power FM stations and room for more non-commercial voices. Besides offering a window for AM stations to apply for FM translator stations, the proposal also would modify the daytime coverage standards, allowing some AM stations to increase their boundaries and nighttime coverage. It also eliminates the so-called ratchet rule, where Class A or B stations making facility changes would have to ratchet back their radiation in the direction of certain other AM stations, and makes a couple other minor changes to antenna rules and authorizations. Radio World .com has a nice roundup of all the proposals in the AM revitalization order. And of course, the public can comment at fcc.gov on the proposal.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. We'll be right back.
James Reed in the Boston Globe reports that efforts have revived to make Roadrunner by the Modern Lovers the official rock song of Massachusetts. In January, a similar bill could not get a floor vote, but last week there was a public hearing about the new bill. Quote, "The song really is a love letter to Massachusetts about driving around the state late at night with the radio on. It's just perfect," unquote, said State Senator Robert Hedlund. Last time, Representatives Josh Cutler and James Cantwell countered with a bill that would have made Aerosmith's Dream On the state rock song. So far this time, there is no announced opposition. Comedian John Hodgman submitted his opinion to the hearing, quote, "The song says, I'm in love with Massachusetts. What more testimony need be heard?" unquote. Boing Boing reports that Wikimedia's case against the National Security Agency was dismissed by U.S. District Judge T.S. Ellis III, saying that they couldn't prove the NSA was intercepting data between Wikipedia and its users. Wikimedia, the parent organization for Wikipedia, never got to challenge the legality of United States government surveillance and instead fought over standing in the case. Judge Ellis wrote that, quote, "Plaintiffs insist that Wikipedia's over 1 trillion annual internet communications is significant in volume, but size is always relative. For example, $1 trillion are of enormous value, whereas 1 trillion grains of sand are but a small patch of beach," unquote. Ellis reasoned that the only people who could challenge NSA surveillance would be those told by the government they were being spied upon. Just because media reports that the government is culling through millions of metadata points doesn't prove that some of the metadata was Wikimedia's, the judge said. The American Civil Liberties Union represents Wikimedia in the case and said, quote, "There's no question that the NSA is capturing and searching through their communications. That's something the court and everyone else should find extremely disconcerting." The Senate voted 74 to 21 October 27th in favor of the Cybersecurity Information Sharing Act, CISA. The bill was called by some senators necessary for national defense, while others said it was another needless way for the government to its own citizens. The Senate passed a version of CISA close to legislation passed in the House earlier this year, but the details will have to be worked out in committee. Quote, "The incentive and the framework it creates is for companies to quickly and massively collect user information and ship it to the government," unquote, said Mark Jacox, a legislative analyst for the civil liberties group the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Wired reported that Apple, Reddit, Twitter, the Business Software Alliance, the Computer and Communications Industry Association, and other tech firms opposed the bill. Quote, "Even the Department of Homeland Security itself has warned in a July letter that the bill could flood the agency with information of, quote, dubious value, unquote, at the same time as it's, quote, sweeps away privacy protections," unquote, Wire reported. And presidential candidate Bernie Sanders commented just before the vote, quote, "People have a right to make a telephone call without that information being collected by the government," unquote. Guardian newspaper is reporting that the Internal Revenue Service in the United States bought several Stingray devices between 2009 and 2012. Stingrays are IMSI catchers, or cell site simulators, small devices that pretend to be cell phone towers in order to catch all local metadata and some content from phones which connect to them. Quote, "Despite their extensive capabilities, they require only a low-level court order called a PEN register, also known as a trap and trace, to grant permission for their use, unquote, the Guardian story says. The Harris Corporation, which makes the Stingrays, are ultra-secretive about the devices. An April Guardian report revealed non-disclosure agreements that local police and prosecutors were forced to sign with the FBI before using Stingrays. The documents demanded local authorities withdraw or even drop cases rather than reveal their use as the source of information. In September, The Guardian reported that this withholding of discovery evidence by Baltimore police could lead to 2,000 cases being overturned. The American Civil Liberties Union and various news outlets have now shown that at least 13 federal agencies have Stingrays now with the IRS disclosure. Nate Wessler, an ACLU attorney, told The Guardian, quote, "The info showing that they are using Stingrays is generally consistent with the kinds of investigative tactics that they are engaging in, and it shows the wide proliferation of this very invasive surveillance technology," unquote. The American Civil Liberties Union of Northern California has obtained some documents about the Stingray units after a protracted legal battle, Wired reports. In the documents, the Department of Justice acknowledges that the surveillance technology to locate cellular phones is, quote, "an issue of some controversy," unquote. But Wired reports the documents also reveal that the Stingray devices that are about a suitcase in size can also record telephone calls. Stingrays don't just troll for all the metadata in the area, but also can pick up actual calls and record them. You can see that full report in Wired magazine. So it may have seemed like the end of the world this week. On television, they were reporting about a wild surveillance blimp that got untethered in Maryland and blew away to Pennsylvania, wreaking terror that sounded like an Orson Welles Halloween radio play. The long tether from the blimp dragging along the ground, knocking over power lines, cutting through cars, and generally wreaking havoc on the countryside.
F-16s scrambled up and down the coast.
An Army surveillance blimp that broke away from a military base in Maryland, wreaking havoc that left 27,000 people without power.
In the sky over Bloomsburg, Pennsylvania this afternoon, a top-secret runaway military balloon known as an aerostat.
And it knocked down our power at school, and it knocked down Columbia's power.
Privacy advocates concerned about its ability to collect data, and members of Congress concerned about the cost.
Lights out for us at Fowlersville and 47. See, you lost power out there also. Route 11 dead.
You ready? Okay, go.
Master, this is recorded through a fly here.
Sounded a bit like the radio recording of the Hindenburg disaster from May 6, 1937. That was when the German passenger airship LZ-129 Hindenburg caught fire just as it was attempting to moor at a naval air station in Lakehurst, New Jersey. Herbert Morrison's radio eyewitness account of the Hindenburg is one of the most recognizable audio clips from the 20th century, and certainly from radio's early days. Let's listen to that chilling broadcast from 1937, the Hindenburg broadcast.
We both flew down from Chicago yesterday afternoon aboard one of the giant new 21-passenger flagships of American Airlines. It took us only 3 hours, 55 minutes to fly nonstop from Chicago to New York. When we landed at Newark, we found another flagship of American Airlines waiting to take us to Lakehurst with our equipment when we were ready to go. The Hindenburg left Frankfurt, Germany, Tuesday evening, rather, at 7:30, their time. And for better than 2.5 days, they've been speeding through the skies over miles and miles of water here to America. Now they're coming in to make a landing of the Zeppelin. I'm going to step out here and cover it from the outside. So as I move out, we'll just stand by a second. Well, here it comes, ladies and gentlemen. We're out now outside of the hangar, and what a great sight it is. A thrilling one. It's a marvelous sight. It's coming down out of the sky, pointed directly towards us and toward the mooring mast. The mighty diesel motors just roared, their propellers biting into the air and throwing it back into a gale-like whirlpool. No wonder this great floating palace can travel through the air at such a speed with these powerful motors behind it. Now, a field that we thought active when we first arrived has turned into a moving mass of cooperative action. The landing crews have rushed to the posts and spots, and orders are being passed along, and last-minute preparations are being completed for the moment we have waited for so long. The ship is riding majestically toward us like some great feather, riding as though it was mighty, mighty proud of the place it's playing in the world's aviation. The ship is no doubt bustling with activities we can see. Orders are shouted to the crew. The passengers are probably lining the windows, looking down at the field ahead of them, getting their glimpse of the mooring mast. It's practically standing still now. They've dropped ropes out of the nose of the ship, and it's been taken a hold of down on the field by a number of men. It's starting to rain again. The rain had cracked up a little bit. The back motors of the ship are just holding it just enough to keep it from... It bursts into flames. Get it started. It's rising terrible. Oh, my. Get out of the way, please. It's burning, bursting into flames, and it's falling on the mooring mast and all the folks between it. This is terrible. This is one of the worst catastrophes in the world. Oh, four or 500 feet into the sky, and it's a terrific crash, ladies and gentlemen. The smoke and the flames now, and the frame is crashing to the ground, not quite to the mooring mast. All the humanity and all the passengers screaming around here. I can't even talk to people and friends are out there. I can't talk, ladies and gentlemen. Honestly, it's just like a massive smoking wreckage. And everybody can't hardly breathe and talk and screaming. Lady, I'm sorry. Honestly, I can hardly breathe. I'm going to step inside while I cannot see it. Charlie, that's terrible. Listen, folks, I'm going to have to stop for a minute because I've lost the voice. This is the worst thing I've ever witnessed.
This week in radio news, we're also tuning in to radio art from around the world. This week, let's hear a short excerpt from Kate Donovan and David Lee, who produced a version of Richard Foreman's Film is Evil, Radio is Good. Film is Evil, Radio is Good is a radio adaptation of Richard Foreman's theater piece about the difference in perception between the audible and the visible that claims the visual medium of film is grounded in artifice and lies and that, quote, radio is good because its metaphysical principle is like the radiations that sustain all life in the universe itself. The project was commissioned by Project Radio in Leeds, England, and originally streamed there, subsequently broadcast at Colabo Radio in Berlin in October. Here is an excerpt of Film is Evil, Radio is Good from Kate Donovan and David Lee.
Do you ever listen to this radio station? Do you ever hear me broadcasting late at night to whoever might be out there in the darkness? I invented the words to this song. Pay attention, please.
When day is done and shadows fall, I dream of you. When day is done, I think of all the joys we knew. That yearning, returning to hold you in my arms won't go, dear, I know, dear. Without you, night has lost its charms. When day is done and grass is wet with twilight's dew, my lonely heart is singing with the sun. Although I miss your tender kiss the whole day through, I miss you most of all when day is done.
Evil. Evil. Film is evil.
Pay attention to this.
When something goes through the ear, it goes straight to the heart. But when it goes through the eye, it's the brain that gets it, and that's the bad news, testifies Mrs. Mabel Williams of Chapel Allerton, Leeds.
Well, there's more to say, certainly. Keep the ball rolling, please.
Dr. Max Jacobson of Wakefield explains that what you see, i.e. film, you tend to believe. Bad, bad, bad. But what goes in through the ear, you supplement with your own creative imagining. Thank you, Dr. Max Jacobson.
I thank you also, Doctor.
To answer a question posed by William Deegan of Bradford, what hypnotizes the eye and so blinds you to the possibilities of self-recognition is what we self-confidently proclaim as evil. Film is therefore essentially evil. Hope that helps, Mr. Deegan.
Furthermore, somebody who thinks as we do, 15-year-old Annie Wupperman of Headingley, Leeds, points out that filmmakers often go out into the world pretending to themselves that the world they are capturing on film becomes thereby their own personal property. Certainly not true, says Annie.
We might point out to some of our more mature listeners that what Annie refers to could be thought of as an almost sexual exploitation of the material world by the invariably ego-obsessed maker of practically all contemporary films.
Of course, literally hundreds of other listeners we haven't time to mention by name have written to us expressing very similar ideas, namely that film is evil, and radio, thank goodness, is a good medium, even if occasionally misused.
Radio, the spiritual potential of all that radiates like the sun. Like the penetrating God consciousness, said the ancient Hebrews, penetrates invisibly to the heart.
Brain damage. Permanent brain damage.
That was an excerpt of Film is Evil, Radio is Good, a Richard Foreman adaption by Kate Donovan and David Lee, commissioned by Project Radio in the United Kingdom. I'm Tom Rowe for Wave Farm Radio and WGXC. This has been This Week in Radio News. The preceding show was recorded at Wave Farm's WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.